This is Fresh Air. Head Start is one of the few programs from President Johnson's War on Poverty to survive intact into the 90s. Although never fully funded and never uniformly successful, it has withstood ideological battles and funding threats for nearly 30 years. Since the 60s, it has served 11 million children, providing education, health care, and social services to disadvantaged preschoolers in poor neighborhoods across the country. President Bush authorized a $600 million increase in the Head Start budget for 1993, the largest increase in the program's history. But as my guest Edward Ziegler points out, that's still $3 billion short of the goal set by the Head Start Reauthorization Act in 1990, which called for the enrollment of every eligible child by 1995. Edward Ziegler was one of the founders of the Head Start program and is one of the champions of child care in this country. He's a professor of psychology at Yale and the co-author of a new book called Head Start. He told me that from the beginning, the expectations for Head Start were too high.
The idea that we could take children out of poverty and put them into a program. Remember, the first program in Head Start was either 6 weeks or 8 weeks in the summer preceding a child's entry into school. That was so Pollyannish and overly optimistic. We've learned a lot since 1965. Clearly, even when we went to a full year, half-day program, we still were pushing what I've referred to as an inoculation model, the notion that you can take a child at 1 year in his life and inoculate him against all the ravages of poverty. That's akin to telling parents, well, gee, if you'll just be a good parent for 1 year in the child's life, then the child will be forever perfect.
Do you think there was something naive about the whole war on poverty?
Well, I can still remember my friend Sergeant Shriver announcing on Meet the Press that we will end poverty in America within 10 years. That was vintage 1965. Poverty is worse and uglier today than it was in 1965. More children are encapsulated in poverty than then. So in many ways, it was naive. On the other hand, it was uplifting and optimistic. People like President Johnson and Sergeant Shriver had a real commitment, a belief that the federal government could indeed intervene and do something about poverty. It was America's finest hour in certain ways, in the sense, I mean, take Head Start, for example. The notion that a country could start planning a program for poor children in the winter of 1964 and put 560,000 children into that program the following summer, that took the work of idealistic people all over the country. We saw people across ethnic lines, across socioeconomic classes, rolling up their sleeves to do this for young children.
You write about the range of programs from excellent to poor. Has that always been the case with Head Start?
Yes, it has been. One of the problems that we inherited with Head Start, I'm afraid, was our decision to start so large and so quickly meant that we put into place many programs of dubious quality. So we have been spending the last 27 years trying to get each and every Head Start program up to the quality level that is envisioned in the Head Start model.
Why has it been so difficult to standardize the quality of Head Start?
Because the monitoring system of Head Start is the only program in the United States that goes directly from the federal government to local communities. There are 1,300 Head Start communities. The only monitoring arm for that are the 10 regional offices of the Department of Health and Human Services. That means each of those offices have to monitor 130 programs, roughly. Well, that means what happened during the Reagan years was they didn't even allow the community representatives from the regional offices, didn't give them the money to even travel to the local center. So quality control got away from us because of a penny-wise and pound-foolish decision by the Reagan administration to cut back on the monitoring of Head Start.
When you talk about the difference between excellent Head Start programs and poor-quality Head Start programs, what are the differences that you have observed?
Well, the primary difference is in the training of the teacher, really. That's the key player in determining quality. Does she know what to do with children? I was in one Head Start center not too long ago where the teacher shouldn't have ever been in the classroom. I'm reluctant to call her a teacher. That the children were acting up. These are four-year-olds. She got annoyed. She had the children line up and say out loud in a row, "I am bad. Hmm. I am bad. I am bad."
But how does a teacher like that get into the Head Start system?
If with the money that we're paying Head Start teachers and the lack of demand that these teachers be trained, people could become a Head Start teacher with nothing but a high school education, not really understand children. We pay very little. What good, highly qualified, well-trained person is going to take a job for $12,000 a year?
One of the criticisms of Head Start is that some research has found that the gains made from Head Start are lost after 2 years of school. What can you tell us about that research?
The research is solid. The fact of the matter is, remember, you have a one-year, half-day program, and that's an inoculation model. The notion that somehow or other the child then comes to school and you've done all that is necessary. The fact is children need environmental nutrients at each and every age. We actually, 2 years at the beginning of a Head Start, started follow-through, which we thought would be the solution. You have to follow Head Start with a program in the schools. We thought Chapter 1 was going to do that. I think what we should do is take the $6 billion, three times the amount of money we're spending on Head Start, utilize that money to provide Head Start-like programs in kindergarten, first, second, and third grade. The other aspect that has to be changed if we're really going to impact the growth and education of poor children is let's not wait, as Head Start does, for children to be 3 or 4 years old. We are really going to have a program, I think, that begins when the child is in utero, prenatal care of the parent. In fact, I'm busily these days preparing for President Clinton a new Head Start for America for the years 0 to 3, and my hope is that Hillary Clinton will play the same role in this program that Lady Bird Johnson did in the original Head Start program, namely be its honorary chairperson.
What kind of argument can you make to Congress, which, of course, is faced with enormous fiscal problems, to say that a program like Head Start or a program that's even more comprehensive than that should be fully funded?
That argument is rather easy to make today, I think, especially in the current concern about investing in human capital, the distinction between costs and investments that Secretary of Labor Reich has made and President-elect Clinton has made. The fact is Head Start and programs of this kind are not costs. They're really investments. We have cost-benefit analysis that are pretty convincing that indicates that $1 spent on preschool education saves you $5 of other costs down the track. We have even more impressive data on Head Start-like interventions and, for instance, inoculations. I mean, every time we inoculate a child, for every dollar we invest in inoculations, we save $10 down the track. So I think this argument can be made. The problem, of course, is our great budget deficit. But I remain optimistic because these arguments, I think, are convincing and telling ones.
Edward Ziegler is one of the founders of the Head Start program and the co-author of a new book called Head Start. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Edward Ziegler about the Head Start program, a program that he helped to found back in the 60s. Another issue that I know that you've been trying to champion for some years now is the whole issue of child care. You co-wrote the Child Development Act back in 1971. You described that act as your greatest hope and your greatest disappointment. Why didn't it go anywhere back in 1971?
I think it was primarily demographics. There wasn't a realization of the real need for child care in America back then. The women's movement was still in the future. There wasn't great concern. As a result, we lost all of our lead time. The fact of the matter is that today, I think the greatest tragedy of America is the fact that we have so many two-career families So we have millions of children being placed every day into child care, often at very, very young ages. 54% of mothers with babies under 1 year of age are in the out-of-home workforce. The analyses that we've done and the data that I've seen indicates to me that about 70% of the child care settings in America are poor in quality.
How poor are they? And describe for us what you mean by that.
I'm talking about centers with untrained personnel running the child care center. I'm talking about, remember, the average pay for a child care worker in America today is $5.35 an hour. We have a turnover rate in child care of over 40% a year. So adults come and go, and we know children need constancy. There's no pay, there's no status in being a child care worker. As a result, that system really is a very, very borderline system. The problem is there are very, very good child care centers. We know how to deliver high-quality child care for children of every age that will put these children on the track to school readiness. I mean, what worries me is while this nation is so worried about school readiness, which is the first goal of the Education 2000 campaign, I can guarantee you that as a child that has had five lousy years of child care before they ever get to school will not be ready to learn.
Well, what kind of a child care system does this country need now?
I think the mistake we made was to think that the federal government would give us a network of centers the way that Denmark or Sweden does. That was unrealistic. What we're going to have to do is reinvent the American school, have children start school at age 3, make the day long enough so that it has long enough to provide child care while mothers and fathers work. France has such a system. Italy has such a system. There's nothing magic about starting school. And you'd also get good preschool education at the same time. There's no difference between good quality preschool education and good quality daycare except the length of the day.
But that doesn't solve the funding problem, though.
Well, the way we're going to have to fund it is also obvious. In fact, we have schools of the kind I'm describing. They're called schools of the 21st century. They have different names. They're called family resource centers in Connecticut and Kentucky, but they are called schools of the 21st century in Missouri and Kansas and Wyoming. So we're doing these models now. The way we're making ends meet is we're getting federal subsidies for very poor kids, and then we're having more affluent families pay the schools for these services, but on a fee calibrated income, and it's working very well.
So just as an example, let's take a school in a community in Kentucky. If this is a school for the 21st century, as you've described, how does it work?
Well, they have certain programs. The model for the school of the 21st century is you start school at 3, so 3s, 4s, and 5s have full-day child care. Then children 6 to 12, you have before and after school programs. Then you have an information and referral system in the school to help parents get other kinds of services that they need. So you take seriously your family support function. Now we're introducing a health module into these schools. And that's really it. It's not a very complicated idea. The only other piece of it is, okay, if the school starts at 3, how about children 0 to 3? Well, most of those children are in centers we call family daycare, where a mother takes in a half dozen children. So what we do in schools of the 21st century is we take all the family daycare homes around the school, tie them into a network, and put the hub of the network in the school of the 21st century and use that hub to monitor, train, and support family daycare workers. With that model, you now have daycare taken care of from birth right up through age 12.
You've been involved in this whole issue of child care, child development. You were director of the Office of Child Development back in 20-some years ago. When you find out that a child care worker is paid $5.35 an hour to take care of children, do you feel like throwing up your hands and in utter frustration?
No, it makes me very unhappy, but no, I don't throw up my hands. It's a struggle that has to continue. The stakes are very, very high. We're talking about the future of our children, which means we're talking about the future of our country. So I don't have the luxury of throwing out my hands and being that annoyed. I have to find what are the barriers to progress and how can we break down those barriers.
Do you think we're in more accepting, more fertile times when it comes to dealing with the issue and the problems of child care? Or the problems of children in this country?
I think so, because we can now read the future, and we know that as many women as are in the out-of-home workforce, that number is going to increase. And our best prediction is by the year 2010, somewhere between 75 and 80% of all women will be in the out-of-home workforce. So this old saw that demographics drive social policy is on our side. As more and more women work, somebody's going to care for their children, and they're going to insist on better child care. The other big plus is the private sector. The fact is, organizations like the Council for Economic Development, these are hard-headed CEOs, businessmen. They now see the relationship between child care and human development and the later productivity of their workers. So they have become a very potent force in helping us get legislation through and speaking to these issues.
So you're optimistic.
I am optimistic.
Well, I thank you, Edward Ziegler, for joining us today. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Edward Ziegler is a co-founder of the Head Start program and co-author of the new book called Head Start. This is Fresh Air.